Many of you have asked us for a longer podcast, a full version of each Sci-Fi show. Well, we heard you, and now you can listen to each full show. No need to have to keep juggling and clicking to the next section. It will come up automatically, just like on the radio. You'll hear the billboard at the top letting you know what's coming up, should you wish to fast forward. So here we go. Hope you enjoy Science Friday. Do you tweet at the table, Facebook your friends when you're out with other friends? This hour, Sherry Turkle joins us to talk about our love affair with robots, smartphones, and social networks. They're certainly not going away anytime soon, so what's the best way to deal with them? Plus, a study that suggests speaking two languages isn't just handy for your Roman holiday, but that a bilingual upbringing may actually make infants more perceptive to new information. Could the same be true for us older language users? And we'll revisit the issue of genetically modified organisms and whether GM crops can escape the farm to cross with wild relatives and create a super weed. Any reliable evidence for this? Some answers in your questions after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Like me, you might have a nice collection of dusty Berlitz phrase books hanging out in your garage left over from your last European vacation. You might even crack one open to learn to say, Mi piace, Science Friday. Speaking more than one language has added benefits to finding your way around a foreign country or perhaps speaking Spanish to your neighbor. You hear about the possibilities all the time, like sharper brains, later onset of Alzheimer's, stuff like that. Well, this week we'll add another piece of good news, a study that suggests bilingual infants are more attentive, more perceptive to languages, even to the ones they're not hearing at home. A promising finding for babies. How did they find that out? And is there any hope for us older students? That's what we'll be talking about. 1-800-989-8255. And you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Janet Worker is a professor and Canada Research Chair in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Worker.
Thank you.
Nice to be here. You're welcome. Tell us about this study. What did you find out? What were you looking for?
Right. It was a fun study. As you probably know, babies are prepared at birth to learn language or languages. And in previous work, we had shown that babies can discriminate languages just by watching silent talking faces. So they see a bilingual speaker, you turn the sound off, and they can tell when it changes from one language, English, to when the person stops speaking English and starts speaking French, even with no sound. But we had shown in previous work that by 7 or 8 months of age, babies who are growing up monolingual in English can't do that anymore, whereas babies who are growing up bilingual in French and English can. So what we asked here is, are bilingual infants learning the characteristics of each of their native languages? I mean, clearly they are. The bilingual English-French babies could maintain this sensitivity, which might help them keep English and French apart as they're acquiring them. But what we ask now is this a specific sensitivity just to the two languages that the baby is being exposed to, or as a function of having to pay attention to the cues that will distinguish the two languages in their world if they're growing up bilingual? Do bilingual babies learn something more general? Do they learn to pay attention to the cues in language that might allow them to keep any two languages apart? So to address this question, my colleague in Barcelona, Nuria Sebastian-Gallas, and I, together with our students Whitney Wycombe and Barbara Alboredo, asked whether Spanish-Catalan bilingual infants could also keep English and French apart, languages they'd never seen before, at 8 months of age. Mm-hmm. So, again, we filmed bilingual English and French speakers, and the babies saw the speakers one at a time. They saw a videotape of, let's say, speaker A reciting a sentence, in English, and then again another sentence in English, speaker B, a sentence in English, etc. And the babies watched for a while. And after a while, the babies get bored, and they're not very interested in watching anymore. And so then to determine whether the babies can discriminate a change from one language to the other, we show them the same women, one at a time, reciting more new sentences, either in the language they had seen before, English, or in the language they hadn't seen before, French. And what we found is that 8 months of age, monolingual Spanish babies and monolingual Catalan babies can't tell the difference, just like the English monolingual babies. However, the bilingual Spanish-Catalan babies, so babies who are growing up with two languages, Spanish and Catalan, from birth, could distinguish spoken visual English from spoken visual French, even though neither of the languages was familiar. They showed an interest in the language change and started looking longer again.
So they paid attention even as the language was changed.
That's right. And so if they can't discriminate the language change, what happens is they see these same three women reciting yet new sentences in a new language, but it's the same women. And if they haven't pulled out something about the language, they'll continue to get bored, and their looking time will continue to be lower and lower. However, if they can tell the difference between the two languages, hey, she's doing something different than she was before, then they will be interested again, just like all of us. They're interested in novelty, and their looking time, their attention gets longer.
Now, can we generalize from here to, you know, suggest that bilinguals are more perceptive in general, they're better at paying attention or more alert to other things besides just the speech?
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the really interesting questions. So as a function of keeping two languages apart, are bilinguals just learning about the characteristics of languages? That in itself would be quite a substantial thing to learn. But in addition, are they learning something more general?
Mm-hmm.
And in the realm of perception, in my lab, we haven't really addressed that question yet. We haven't answered that question yet. But there is work from a lot of other labs that suggests that as a function of growing up bilingual, babies are learning something more general.
So we should not try to teach them just one language. Having a bilingual family is an advantage.
Well, I think that's what the work shows.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's the case that if you're a monolingual, you should run out tomorrow and try to learn a new language so that you could speak two languages to your child and give them the opportunity to grow up bilingual. I think what the work shows is that if in your home more than one language is spoken, that's something to be comfortable with, and it's an opportunity to provide your infants with both languages because there may be advantages that accrue. So I could tell you a little about some of the other advantages if you wanted to hear about
it. Sure, give us one. Give us one or two.
Sure. And so the claim that's made is that people who speak two languages have to have both of them active all the time. So if they're bilingual with French and English, both French and English are active all the time, but that they have to inhibit one of those languages when they're speaking the other one, and that this may confer some more general advantages in cognitive processes. And so, for example, even in infancy, there's work shows, this is by Aggie Kovacs and Jacques Mailer, that even at 7 months of age, a baby who's growing up bilingual, is all babies are able to learn, like if they hear a particular sound, to turn their head to the right. That's easy enough, and that they'll be rewarded with something. But a bilingual baby at 7 months can learn now to inhibit that response and instead turn their head to the left. It's something that's more difficult for a monolingual baby to learn.
Wow.
And people think that might have to do with their continual experience with having to shift from one language to another in acquisition.
So they can locate the source rather than just turning their head in one direction.
Well, it's not so much that they're learning, that they're locating the source. It's that they're learning one rule and then substituting that with a second rule.
Mm.
And by 12 months of age, they can learn two rules simultaneously, like keeping track of the perceptual cues of each of two different languages or the structure of each of two different languages.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And good luck with your work.
Thank you, Ira.
Janet Worker is a professor and Canada Research Chair in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. How long can you live without your cell phone? I don't mean literally, of course. I'm talking about not having your cell phone close by to tweet, to text, to upload a picture to Facebook. How many times have you seen an entire room full of people wrapped up in a digital cocoon, comforted by these texts zinging in, by the endless notifications that keep piling and pulling them to the telephone? But in this world where we prefer texts and emails to phone calls, let alone in-person meetings, are we missing something? Or are our children born into this digital age and handed an iPad when they are six? What have they learned about interacting verbally with other humans in a conversation which takes place live, up close, and personal? And what role do we want that technology to play in our lives? Because aren't we the ones using the technology? Or is it more like technology is using us? Well, my next guest is a psychologist who has made a career out of studying how people interact with technology. Sherry Turkle is author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. She's professor of social studies of science at MIT in Cambridge. She joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Lovely to be here.
And I just want to remind everybody, keeping in the theme of what we're just talking about, you can tweet us, text us, tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and go to Facebook at Facebook/SciFry. And our number is 1-800-989-8255. We never used to have to say that stuff before, did we?
That's right. You just had to listen.
Do people listen anymore? Or are they just watching text?
Well, in my research, people tell me over and over that they'd rather text than talk. People don't like to use the telephone. Mm-hmm. Telephone companies love to sell you voice plans because they know you won't use the voice part of the voice plan.
And so that you're gonna get the free, like the razor blades of old, you're going to get the free voice plan. Hopefully you'll use the digital side and the text side. Of it.
Absolutely.
There was a really interesting. Your book is so interesting, and there was one interesting part that I want to pick out now, and that was a girl you spoke to who said, speaking of speech, that she can't imagine carrying on a conversation on a telephone because it's so personal.
Yes. Well, it is. I mean, even a conversation on the radio, you know, you can hear what this young woman meant was that too much, she went on to say that too much might show. And essentially, when you compose a text, when you compose an email, although teens don't like to use email, they're mostly talking about text and instant messages, you know, you can perform
right
on a text. You can compose it the way you want on a Facebook status update. You can get it exactly the way you want it. And a generation has gotten used to performing themselves.
Well, that's a great point, and we have to take a break, and I want to get right back to this idea of performance and celebrity. It almost seems like we are living in an age of celebrity, right? Celebrities are everywhere, and they're most important. And in your book, that seems to be what you have discovered, too, that there are teenagers in there, there are young adults in there, who think that if they're not performing online, they're nobody.
Yes, and more than that, they feel as though if they're not sharing online, they're nobody. They get into a mode of being that I describe as I share, therefore I am. They go from I have a feeling, I'd like to make a call, to I want to have a feeling, I need to send a text. In other words, the constitution of a feeling becomes, in order to have the constitution of a feeling, you need to be texting someone about it. And that becomes a problem because they become dependent on other people even for knowing what they're feeling. And it's a kind of use of other people that can get them into trouble. They don't develop a kind of necessary autonomy that's so important for an adolescent to develop.
Now, why is that different from, let's say, the need to share your life with other people before electronic devices, you know, over the fence or through the old telephone or something like that?
It's the fact that it happens as you're feeling the feeling instantly, carrying it with you all the time. I mean, these kids are literally texting as they're walking, as they're talking, in the middle of talking to other people, interrupting the life as it's being lived in order to share with people who aren't even there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we've never seen before teenagers wanting to share their feelings, but there really is something qualitatively different here. There's a wonderful saying in psychology: if you don't teach your children how to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. And that's really the concern here, is whether we're all so busy communicating that we're not learning how to be alone with ourselves in a way that's constructive, in a way where we kind of know the boundaries of ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's the concern.
And you're saying that this technology is not going to be going away anywhere, and that we'd better learn to understand those consequences and deal with them.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm absolutely not saying we should unplug. I'm absolutely not saying we should think of ourselves as addicted. Because if you're addicted, you know, there's only one thing to do. You have to get rid of the substance. We are not going to get rid of our cell phones, our smartphones. It's kind of like food. You don't get rid of food. You need to develop a healthy relationship with it in order to live with it in the most constructive way possible. My favorite line in my book, if an author is allowed to have a favorite line, is just because we grew up with the internet, we think the internet is all grown up. And it's not. It's there for us to make, and it's there for us to make in the best way possible. It's time to make the corrections.
And how, if your kid is young enough to, you know, is a newborn or someone, let's say, 5-6 years old,
yeah,
who's in this, how do you as a parent deal with this?
Well, it's actually very simple. There was a wonderful article by David Pogue just in The Times yesterday where he poses the question of his, I think it was his 6-month-old, who loves his iPad.
6-year-old.
Was it 6-year-old who
yes.
loves his iPad?
Yes.
I've been reading about toddler, actually. I've been reading articles about toddlers, so I thought he's even younger. And he says something pretty interesting. He says he loves to have it at the dinner table, and he gets bizarrely upset if you take it away. And to me, the two rules are it shouldn't be at the dinner table, because those are the times when I find kids complaining that their parents are texting at the dinner table and using their BlackBerries at the dinner table. I think the dinner table should be a kind of sacred space when families need to come together, no matter how much technology they need to use at other times and places.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't use it at dinner. You don't use it at the playground when your kid is trying to show off to you his moves or her moves. That's not the time to be buried in your phone. And then David Pogue also says that the child becomes bizarrely upset if you try to take it away. And any time your 6-year-old becomes, you feel he's bizarrely upset when it's being taken away, well, then, you know, it's too much.
Mm-hmm. You point out an interesting place where you were shocked to see it happening is in breastfeeding.
Yes.
Where women were texting while they were breastfeeding. What is so bad with that?
Well, because breastfeeding is a time when the bonding between mother and child is most intense and probably most consequential. More is happening in breastfeeding than milk delivery.
Mm.
That's a time when the child senses the mother's relaxation, senses the full attention of the mother. And you know, when I interview children for the years and years that I've studied kids, you know, for this book, the thing they complain about most is they feel the technology is the competition. The minute they met this technology, it was the competition.
Mm.
And here you have the kind of the primal scene for the child, a mother breastfeeding, and it doesn't have to be breastfeeding. It could be with a bottle.
Mm.
And breastfeeding with one hand and texting with another. I have kids who talk about parents who read Harry Potter with one hand and they're texting under the blankets with another. Pushing the swing with one hand, texting with another. Our children are complaining that they don't have our full attention, and we're going to pay a price for that.
A backlash down the road.
A backlash, yeah.
Well, let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Grant in San Antonio. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Ira. Three quick little comments. If you prefer to text me than talk to me, I don't need to communicate with you at all. Number two, if these kids have a feeling of self-loathing and worthlessness, unless they're texting, then they need to put some psychoanalysts and psychiatrists on staff in high schools, because these kids have got a real problem and nobody is addressing it. And thirdly, if you got a six-year-old who gets horrendously upset because you take his cell phone away, then mommy and daddy need to have the stupid slapped out of them.
Oh, pretty harsh. Well, it's harsh love, Grant, there. But let me, Sherry, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little bit, I mean, I must say that I'm more compassionate about the place that we've all come to, because I think that it's taken us, you know, this new technology is here. It's very seductive. None of us had ever seen it before, and it turns out we're very vulnerable to it. And I think we all became, you know, I talk about what technology affords and where we're vulnerable. I think it turned out that we were very vulnerable indeed. And that's why I say it's time to make the corrections. I think we needed to take a little bit of time to see where we were vulnerable and how we're going to work our way out of this. Mm-hmm. So I guess I both agree, and I
right.
think, like, I guess I'm a therapist, and I think if you begin by thinking, but if you begin by self-loathing, you're never going to, you know, work your way out of a problem.
Well, what about people who can learn things interacting online and become more sociable offline? Is there a use for that? There's a recent study out of the University of Texas that suggested that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm very interested in that study because it defines sociability in terms of the things that the network can let you do socially. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very careful about defining sociability in terms of what a social network lets you do socially and seeing that as sociability.
So, for example,
sharing photographs, that's very sociable. But if you start to code people as sociable for how much they share photos, you may be missing elements of sociability that, in fact, are much more important and precious, like the ability to sit quietly and be empathic as somebody tells you their story and have the patience to really listen, or the sociability that comes from being able to apologize. Online, people don't really apologize. They say, "I'm sorry," and don't really have to, you know, a full apology means, you know, being with someone and seeing how you've hurt them and being there to see that and to, you know, feel bad and experience that you've hurt somebody. That's mm-hmm. part of a full apology. Mm-hmm. And that's sociable. So I worry a little bit that we start to define sociability in terms of what a social network lets us do. Mm-hmm. But I must say that the reason I wrote Alone Together is I think of it as a book of repentance, because for many years, as you know, I mean, I wrote several books in which I looked at the many positive, wonderful things that the social network allows. And I wrote this book because I thought that I had missed something important and something negative that happens when you have the ability that mobility gives you, that mobile technology gives you, to essentially bail out of conversations with the people you're with at any time, to text at funerals, to text at dinner, to text at breakfast, to text at dinner. That's the piece that I missed, and I think that's the piece that I'm trying to draw attention to.
Is it going to get worse?
No, I don't think so. I actually end Alone Together on a note of guarded optimism, because I think that the people I'm talking to, both personally and also in business situations, are not happy. I think they feel that they're too busy communicating to think. They're too busy communicating to be creative. They're too busy communicating really to connect with the people that really most matter to them.
Well,
the mother who's driving 80 miles an hour and she has three kids in the back of the car and she's texting, she's not happy.
Well, that's a point that brings me to what I want. The next point is, do the kids feel like they are on a treadmill and they would like some time off?
I tell many stories in Alone Together of kids who basically want a break. I interview one 16-year-old who, in the course of the interview, it took about an hour, and he's turned off his phone, and then he turns it back on. He has 100 messages, and he looks at me and he says, "How long do I have to continue doing this?" It was a poignant moment. You know, they're on a treadmill. They feel the pressure. They take vacations from Facebook because they feel the pressure of keeping up their profiles, of worrying whether or not if they say they like this band or that band, how it makes them look, and keeping everything consistent and making themselves look thin in their photographs. And I mean, it's an art.
And unless they keep up appearances, right? It's keeping up appearances. And the appearances in this case is how many times do I update my Facebook page?
Yes.
How many texts do I send out? Do I tweet everybody?
And there's a sweet spot.
Yeah, go ahead.
If there's a sweet spot, because too much, you look anxious, and too little, you look like you don't care. I mean, it's in every high school, it's different. And then also there's the problem that they say to me that it used to be that when you graduated high school, you could start fresh in college. There's no starting fresh now.
Hmm.
Your high school friends move right along with you.
Wow.
You know?
Talking with Cheri Turkle, author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, on Science Friday from NPR. And this is just, you know, there are kids who don't know it to be any different than that, do they? They think this is how the world works because they've grown up with this technology.
Yes, I mean, but your question is whether they're going to seek something different, I think, is really the question on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying that I call it the nostalgia of the young, that in some ways this question of seeking the full attention that they never had growing up, I think is going to be very interesting to watch as it plays out, because they missed something that I think they're going to be looking for. And
is it going to show up in behavior?
I think so. And I think it's also going to show up in, I think they're going to be supported because I think it's going to start to show up in business. I think also we're too busy, you know, more and more studies are starting to show that what's happening in personal life is also happening in business. I mean, when people are getting 500 emails a day, they're too busy communicating to work, to think. And another thing that's happening is that when you start to get that many emails, when people start to get mad at you if you're not immediately responding to them, you start to ask people questions that you know they can answer quickly, but you start to ask simpler questions. We start to give simpler answers. You kind of dumb down the questions. You dumb down the answers. We kind of all put each other on cable news. I mean, we say that our world is ever more complicated, but we're asking and answering simpler questions. So I think there's going to be a correction. I do think there's going to be a correction.
And how will that happen? Who will start that?
I think it's going to begin in families. It's going to begin in families. Yes,
discipline?
I think it's going to begin with dinner. I think it's going to begin at dinner time with families putting away the phones at dinner. I think it's going to begin with families wanting to spend some time together after dinner and not just go each to their room with their devices.
So this book is a catharsis for you?
This book was a labor of love. I wrote it as my daughter was growing up, and I tried to put in the book the conversations that I thought her generation would be having.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about a catharsis.
Well,
labor of love.
You said it was because of all the other writings you had done years before.
I said it was a book of repentance.
Repentance.
A book of repentance. In some way, I got something wrong. I tell my students, call me not prescient. Call me not prescient. I didn't see when I talked about the internet as a place where people would experiment with identity, mm-hmm. I imagined that you would live your life in your real life, and here's the not prescient part, and that then you would go to your computer and you would have, you know, some time where you experimented with identity. And then you would go and live your life. You know, I didn't imagine that you would always be able to bail out of your ongoing life with the people in your life really at any moment, so that you would be putting the people in your world on pause to take a call in the way that we've now come to see as completely normal.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and take maybe a call or two for Sherry Turkle, author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. Last Friday, we talked to Dr. Nina Fedoroff, the new president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, about some of her goals for the AAAS. And towards the end of the interview, we ended up talking about genetically engineered crops, an area of Dr. Fedoroff's expertise. And that exchange, I'll tell you, generated a storm of letters and comments on our website urging us to do a follow-up segment. And let me just replay a brief clip from last week's show. But there are cases where these crops have, so to speak, leaked out of the farms where they were started or the fields and gone to other places no one thought they would go to.
No.
There are no cases of that?
No.
I beg to differ.
Crops don't leak out. We have domesticated crops over a very long period of time, like tens of thousands of years. And crops get... seeds get carried. Sometimes if they're very small seeds, they get scattered off trucks. Pollen
that's not,
travels.
That's not leaking. That's what I would call leaking out.
But they're still the same plants, and they're domesticated plants. They're not wild plants. So you can talk about it as leaking, but I don't know what that helps. It doesn't. It's not like agricultural plants take over the... They're not weeds. They're not invasive weeds. Mm-hmm. They're highly domesticated crop plants. Mm-hmm. So they in some cases, if you've got last year's crop that comes up in the field when you don't want it to come up, it's called a volunteer. It's a management problem. It's not an ecological problem.
And that's what our conversation was last week about transgenic seeds and pollen leaking out, as I call it, beyond the plant itself and maybe creating unintended problems. Could there possibly be crosses that the pollen makes with wild relatives and creating something different, maybe a new kind of super weed? Joining me to discuss these, Nina Fedoroff is back. She's a visiting professor at King Abdullah University in Saudi Arabia, and even a Pew Professor of Biology at Penn State. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Fedoroff.
Delighted to be back.
Also with us is Allison Snow. She's a plant ecologist and biology professor at The Ohio State University in Columbus. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Snow.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You heard that quote, I'm hoping. What are your thoughts on this? Are there any examples of crops that maybe didn't behave or leaked out, as I call them?
Well, I think you were right to say that the genes from GM crops have leaked out in the pollen and the seeds, and just the fact that the genes have moved has caused some problems. But I think what you're wanting to focus on now is what kind of weedy problems might result from that. And as a typical scientist, I'm going to say it depends. There have been some cases of weeds acquiring traits from genetically modified crops that are causing some problems. One of the most well-known ones is canola, which is one of the few crops that's actually genetically engineered. There's soybean, corn, cotton, and canola. And canola itself can be a weed, both as a volunteer, as Dr. Fedoroff mentioned, in the same field, but it can also spread along roadsides. And there are reports of canola with genetically modified herbicide resistance spreading along roadsides and into lots of areas, including farmers' fields. And it is considered a weed problem. It's one of the top 20 weeds in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your work on sunflowers. Didn't you find that insect resistance genes in genetically modified sunflowers might be a potential problem if it got into wild sunflowers?
We did find some evidence for that, yes. We did some experiments and found that a gene for insect resistance in wild sunflower can give these weeds a big boost in the number of seeds that they make, but that has not been commercialized, so it hasn't actually happened yet. And so this is one of the future scenarios that we think about is what are some traits that could get into weeds that could cause them to become much more prolific.
Mm-hmm. Nina, any thoughts from last week?
Well, I think what Allison said is absolutely correct. It is a management problem. She spoke about, as I had mentioned in my segment, that some seeds can fall off of trucks and so forth and get into farmers' fields. Those, again, are management problems in the farmers' field. They're not an ecological problem.
Allison Snow, do you agree it's just a management problem?
To an extent, I agree, but when you manage weeds, you have to use different types of herbicides, and Roundup or glyphosate is one of the most ecologically friendly herbicides out there. So if that doesn't work anymore, farmers in Canada are using a cocktail of herbicides now to control the volunteer canola, including things like 2,4-D. So these management problems can translate into environmental problems in some cases.
I'd like to make a point here. This is not a problem that has anything to do with this particular form of genetic modification. It was a problem with herbicide tolerance long before crops were modified to be herbicide tolerant by molecular techniques. So this is an old problem. It's an old management problem. Weeds do become resistant to herbicides, and it needs to be managed with multiple herbicides.
Dr. Snow?
True, but I think people have called glyphosate, weed scientists consider, I'm not a weed scientist, I'm an ecologist, but weed scientists call glyphosate the herbicide of the century. We're not going to have another herbicide like that. So for that herbicide to stop working is going to cause a lot of economic and environmental problems.
That's Roundup, right?
Roundup, yeah.
And that's a point, but it's hard to see how avoiding herbicide, glyphosate-tolerant plants is going to solve the problem.
Not sure what you mean by that.
Well, you say you focus on the fact that it's a problem, but it is a problem for farmers, and I'm not sure what your implication is when you say it's a problem.
Oh, I'm talking about the case where, say, in California now, there's volunteer canola, feral canola, that people want to get rid of it because it's a weed, and they can't use Roundup anymore, and they can't use 2,4-D because it's not allowed. So it just creates more of a headache for weed management.
Right. I think we both agree that that's the case. But it's not unique to this particular technique for developing glyphosate tolerance, because mm-hmm. that can be done
regular crops can become weedy problems or hybridized with weedy relatives, and so can genetically engineered ones. What I find interesting is that there are certain traits that we haven't been able to use in regular crops until we had the techniques of genetic engineering, and these are not in the evolutionary pathway of the wild relatives, so they're actually new traits that we're looking at every year. New traits are being invented.
And one of the really remarkably beneficial aspects of genetic engineering is that much of the previous methodology for controlling pests and so forth is through chemicals that affect a very broad spectrum of insects, for example, or fungicides that control fungi. But what we are now able to develop are plants that actually resist those pests or diseases, much in the way that we vaccinate people. And that's obviously preferable to using antibiotics, because you can develop antibiotic tolerance, whereas if you vaccinate a person, that person becomes essentially immune to that particular disease.
Let me just jump in and say this is Science Friday from NPR. Dr. Snow?
Okay, yeah, I think those are very good points. I just wanted to return to the point that crop genes do get out into the environment and they do cause problems in some cases, and that because when traits are genetically engineered, we have to pay special attention to the new kinds of traits that may be getting into some of the weed populations. Some of the crops that we have that don't become weedy are great. We don't have to worry about that. But in the future, when we have genetically engineered grasses and trees and algae, I think it's worth paying attention to all of these questions surrounding the movement of the new transgenes.
Now, one point that I'd like to make and underscore here is that this is not a problem that is unique to current methods of genetic modification. This kind of problem has always been in agriculture. As long as we have created derivatives of wild plants that we don't want to cross with wild plants. So I think that the important thing to focus on is that we need to look at the trait, not at the method by which it was produced.
But that's what Dr. Snow was saying. A lot of people are worried, I think, and I'll just say this as representing the public, that you're taking genes from organisms that would never breed naturally in the wild with plants and putting them in there.
That is true. But again, let's focus on the fact that a gene is simply an instruction for making a protein. And today we know that proteins do all the work in organisms, and they're very closely related. So, for example, you have hemoglobin genes, and plants have hemoglobin genes. These code for proteins that bind oxygen. The plants use them for very different things than you use them for. But the point I'm making is that all life is quite closely related and translates the same proteins from the given instructions, whether you put them in one organism or another. So the fact that there are that species get isolated from each other doesn't mean that it's dangerous to take a gene from one to another. It is not inherently dangerous.
If that gene or that plant finds itself in an organically growing field, then can we consider it organic anymore?
No, that's actually not true, because the organic rule allows a certain level of contamination with pollen from other kinds of crops. That's always been a problem with organic farming. It's not a new problem, and the rules actually accommodate that.
Dr. Snow, Allison?
Yes, I mean, I think of organic farmers as a group, a major group, that would like to prevent transgenes from getting into their crops, as well as many countries feel that way. But I'd also like to return to the point of all organisms being related, because now we have the ability, and I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here, Dr. Fedoroff, that we can put pharmaceutical-producing proteins, you know, genes into plants. We can create a lot of genes that go into food plants where we don't really want that in our food. And I think that's what the public is concerned about, that we have pharmaceutical producing rice and corn now that's grown under very high security. But, you know, those are just some of the other issues in addition to the weed questions that the public is concerned about.
But I think that one shouldn't simply mix all those things together, because the stringency with which crops that are producing pharmaceuticals need to be isolated from others depends on the properties of the protein or substance that's being expressed.
Right. And as you said, we need to look at them case by case.
There are regulations that cover all of that, and I think that it's just alarmist to say that any gene is a problem, or new genes are a problem, or genes from other species are problems.
Well,
they're simply
But we need to give them some time before we make a final do we not just need to give them some time before we make a final judgment on any of this?
Well, let me say that the European Union just published a report that summarizes 25 years of research on the safety of genetically modified organisms. And their big conclusion is that the organisms modified by molecular techniques are no more risky than organisms modified by any other technique.
Dr. Snow, I got 10 seconds. Any rebuttal?
They said in that report, it's true. They say that. They say per se. So they mean like in and of themselves. But I think we need to look at the larger context, case by case.
All right. We've run out of time. Thank you, Allison Snow and Nita Fedoroff. And thank you all for joining us today. And we'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.